introduction this afternoon to Myra Jackson, who is has been an active participant in all the day's presentations. She is going to speak this afternoon on what we the people now know, a clearer path toward a new social contract. She is an electrical engineer, a UN representative, and a biosphere consultant. She is a retired electrical engineer, specialized in project management of utility systems and organizational and leadership development. She designed and delivered seminar courses on business management, emotional intelligence, and heart coherent techniques at Harvard, Stanford, USC, UCSF, UCSD, Rockefeller University, and Duke University. She worked with biomedical scientists within Howard Hughes Medical Institute, a medical research organization. In 2006, Myra shifted her professional engineering focus to global policy on the climate crisis. As a UN representative, she participated in the UN Open Working Group that determined 17 sustainable development goals, which were adopted by 193 member states in 2015. Ms. Jackson currently serves on the United Nations Expert Platform on Harmony with Nature and is a delegate to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. She consults to collaborative groups of state, federal, and municipal governments, higher education, companies, utilities, and communities developing responses to sustain their rivers and regional environments. Myra organized and delivered a five-day global freshwater summit focused on the Mississippi River biome in partnership with the Missouri Historical Society. She serves as a creativity and innovation fellow at Colorado College, spring 2021 and 2022. Myra.
Well, thank you. We've gotten here to day five of VABA, Visioning a Better America. And I'm excited to get to GAR. So, in beginning this challenge that you've given us, Richard, to speak to a vision of a better America and to do it in a conversational style without our slides, where we can get away with that. And I've chosen to really go there because what this week has done is really nestled me into a feeling of my own story. And that story, as it plays against this moment in time. And I feel that the human opportunities are particularly stark and wide open for us to explore as we see more of what I call the degradation of our existential crisis. And if I were to show a slide, one slide, it would be a slide of Earth Rise. And it would be that slide because of the way it impacted me as a 10-year-old. It changed forever for me at a critical time when I needed it. Because by the time that not only Earthrise came into being, it really wasn't in the public domain. What really caught my attention of the Earth was the day that I was listening to Walter Cronkite in front of the television on the floor. And here we were in our grand celebration of man's great leap forward. And you could see the astronauts. I'm sure you all could call those photos to mind. And I caught a glimpse of the Earth and I went bananas. because for the first time, this voice I loved hearing across the airwaves, Walter Cronkite, I wanted him to stop. I wanted him to stop and tell me what I was seeing. But we were caught up in the moment of applauding ourselves, right, for landing on the moon. But the moment will stay with me forever, and I feel as though we have been in a transmission being relayed to all humanity about where the focus needs to be, where the center of gravity would be for our lives, for the way we saw ourselves with each other, with the planet, and the way we would govern. So I've been for my lifetime looking for that awakening. And now we've passed 50 years, that anniversary in 2019 of July 1969. And what happened in the year before? We lost Robert Kennedy, we lost Martin Luther King, and several years before, JFK, who launched this race. So we had gone through a lot as a nation and the world looking upon us at that time. So I can see the vitriol, but I felt we missed a key moment, because what happened was we processed the human victory without recognizing we just caught a glimpse of something collectively. We all witnessed together that we did not process. And I feel, honestly, we're still processing it. One thing I know, as I've been looking at who we are as humans, is that we do not see. We perceive what we expect to see. And so unless it can be very jarring for us to take in new sights that we don't have a reference for, and we haven't done a good job of taking in and understanding what does it mean to see this beautiful jewel in the earth that is our home, and to see it as a whole operating organism that we are a part of, not separate from. That, to me, that image, once it fully arises in human consciousness, it will mean that this is home, and that not only is it home, we're embedded in that home. We're a part of it, and we begin to conduct ourselves accordingly. All right, so you want to know my vision? It's that that awakening occurs. But what is so particular about the call to Vaba is that we began by looking at a document that involves the formation of what we call America. And yet I sit on a land that was inhabited by the Piscataway. This was not an empty, open territory without people here. And I sit in a watershed that is the Seneca River in Germantown, Maryland. And today, when I ask people where their watershed is, or who were the people that were there, few people can answer that question. I ask you, is this the kind of education of a people who are cared for by the earth, who depend upon the earth, who everything they create is a derivative of the earth, and the earth has no value? We don't have a metrics. We do not have a system that flags us and signals to us how well we're doing in relationship to the planetary being. Yet our well-being is directly linked to the earth. And I'll take this a bold step forward to really let you in on my honest thinking. as a Black woman who holds the mitochondria that passes down through mothers in all of us, including plant life, that I do feel the isms have to do with how we feel about the earth. That this colorism is about earth. It's about our pejorative, negative associations with the earth. It shows up in our language. It shows up in how we treat the earth. And I don't think we've had a chance to stop and consider the impact of the neglect, of the lack of feeling and relationship to the earth that's warranted. It's real interesting that Jefferson was one of the framers. He, with Monroe and Madison, I believe, were deist. There was a conversation going on early in that 17th, 18th century in Europe around just how to hold ideas of theology and God. And where Jefferson came in with some of this brilliant, aspirational language that we find in the Declaration and we find in the preamble, it embodies some of those ideas, and it excites me to be in a conversation around that. Another early experience of mine that I want to bring forward has to do with what I learned from my grandmother and how that matched with what I read of Jefferson's journals. Because when she came to visit us in San Diego for the first time, she opened up my world to seeing what I hadn't seen before. She walked around our canyons in San Diego, and I walked with her. And what she saw was a vibrancy that I had missed. She saw food. We came back literally as if we'd gone to the market, filled with all kinds of vegetables that were edible, medicinal plants, because she could register that. She had knowledge of that. She had never been to the West. But she walked around first. She didn't want to do anything until she walked outside and got to know this part of what I call the mother, that great mother, the earth. But not only that, not only did she teach me what was there alive, and by the way, I'll have to say, where I was living was once the place where many Japanese lived before they were interned. And part of the reason why it was so rich, those canyons, is because they were abandoned. They were nurseries. They were gardens. And my grandma pointed out what was wild and what was cultivated. But she also told me, Dot, as she would call us all, she said, this was once under the ocean. And she scruffed around and she showed me all of the seashells that were all over our land. And it was on a hill because my folks by that time had purchased property on a hill, 5 acres. And I looked at the ocean every day. The mountains to the east, to the south, Tijuana, Mexico. And to the north, this great expanse of what became a suburban sprawl in San Diego, but at that time had an Air Force base. What I also remember of that visit that stood out for me, here I am, young astronomer, always looking up at the sky. Here's my grandmother predicting weather. And that's where she and Jefferson come together. Because all throughout Jefferson's writings are this meticulous ridiculous diary of all of this fascination he had with these instruments he was using. But he was also using the body, just like my grandmother did. She would use the pressure on her tongue to determine when the rain was coming. And in San Diego, her being able to do that, we have this temperature, 72, you know, 72 degrees throughout the years, all that time I was growing up. But boy, was she spot on. And you'd have to just understand, I was a little geeky kid and always reading encyclopedias and comparing them. And she was giving knowledge that I didn't find in books. But this is what it meant to be a part of Earth and Earth peoples. You paid attention to the intelligence and the communication available to you in the natural world. Today, our senses are very dull, and yet we have bodies that are made to correspond with the planetary being. We're of it. We are of it. So I feel an important part of going forward is to not only have what I would call human 101 education, but that we get busy activating dormant capacity within our bodies. You know, I was in 2004 in Indonesia and had just left 48 hours before that tsunami. And what was driven home to me was that here we call ourselves top of the food chain, the most intelligent, and we are really the only species that resist learning from the intelligence of the cosmos itself, cosmos being order and intelligence. And here the elephants went uphill, understood what would be coming. The farmers who paid attention to the elephants followed. And the rest of the folks, many who come in to vacation on those grounds, were caught up in the tsunami that resulted. And here we are on a changing planet, a planet changing radically, and we have no bearings because we've lost that deep connection to the planetary being. And there's going to be movement, and there will be changes, and we're already witnessing them. But attuned to the planetary being, we may know where to step. Evolutionary biologists tell us now, you know, this is a time when competition is not in our best interest. David Sloan Wilson has written a book on that very thing. And it speaks to altruism, that we have in our genetics the ability to organize and be cooperative and collaborative. He calls that altruism. And in this time, that is the way that we will be able to continue as a species. And I quite agree. I honestly do have a deep sense that we are in that moment very much like those we attribute the early Renaissance to. They didn't know that in the future people would see what they had created by really beginning to read the few books they found from antiquity. Which points to another challenge, is that we've had a presence on the planet that does not want any ideas that contradict a view they're holding to be in the human collective, the masses. We've been talking this week about education in many ways. So I very much feel socially, after coming through several years of not only working in that open working group on the Sustainable Development Goals, wherein during that time, I began working with a team of scientists in Stockholm, who were really scientists from all around the world, working on planetary boundaries, that I began to see not only do we have this planet of which we're a part of, but that planet itself, of course, has its limits. And we were beginning to learn about what those limits look like, and the importance of being able to live within the safe operating system of this planetary world. And those nine boundaries, of which it's not so important that I name at this time, there's one that got my attention that I made it my business to pay attention to. And that was the one that is the most regenerative, in particular, the most regenerative if we as a society, as human peoples, would pay attention and cooperate, and that is the fresh water boundary. There's climate change, there's the nitrogen phosphates, there are many boundaries of the nine, but that's the most regenerative. It's a slow-moving boundary, and when we work with that, it will respond. It's the one that has created and fostered the comeback of many ecosystems. And so, as we're in this existential crisis, one of the things I feel is my imperative, personally, the crucible I carry, is to encourage a deep return, a deep restoration of the broken bonds with nature, to look where we can, where we live, to restore and regenerate the earth. I think we've got a generation to do it. And some will say in recent weeks, we have gone through another tipping point, of which we have no idea where that ends up, and that timeline has been collapsed. But I feel it's a generation of work ahead of us. And what we have are examples around the world of where this has worked and where we can get this done. One of those that impact me the most is the Lis Plateau in China. A whole denuded landscape that has been restored miraculously. And what is so beautiful about the restoration is that where all that mud and silt was falling into what is called the Yellow River because of that denuded landscape, the millions of people that would lose their lives when that would flood, now that it's been restored and it's full of lush life, and the people who had lived there had always been impoverished, have been able to live very well and send their own grandkids to college, and they're on a different trajectory now. And that landscape, it came together in less than 20 years. It came full on in a generation. So it's well worth the effort. And many of these projects are moving forward even now. We have a good example in Panama, but there's some of these projects going on in Jordan. What I'm interested in is what can we do right now in the U.S.? And this is why the Global Freshwater Summit came about. It really came about from listening to a dear friend, Laura Madden, who had worked on Capitol Hill, by the way, for some years before returning back to her home state of Missouri and the city of St. Louis, a family of Irish immigrants who settled in Missouri. And very young, they encountered a loss of her sister. And she remembered a river, a creek behind her house that one day just stopped flowing. And she had done some research once returning and found out this creek called Coldwater Creek that runs through North County, Missouri, St. Louis in Missouri, was indeed a river that had been flooded with uranium. And that these deaths that they had seen, this cluster of cancers they had seen in the region, were a result of that uranium. Talk about transparency or the lack of transparency in our world. That is a pattern that I think we're coming to a reckoning on in this country. It's not being able to tell the truth about history and about events, of always pushing the dime until who would be culpable is no longer around to pay the price. And this is the case with the uranium. There was no admission, no outward statements of what was exposed, what the people had been exposed to. But the fact is, the barrels of uranium were never secured. They were left on the surface in canisters. And when the baby boom occurred and development began to happen, the dirt that was moved caused all this ionizing radiation to become airborne. And this is why the region saw so many cancer deaths. So it wasn't until we started working on the Global Freshwater Summit to really, because I said to Laura, I said, I will help you, but we can never deal with just one creek. We have to deal with the entire flow of the Mississippi River and Missouri, where they come together. We have to address the whole, not just the creek. So to gather around, this was a social experiment because I had done smaller work. I wanted to call in everyone who was working on behalf of the Mississippi River. Fresh waters. Here again, fresh waters is one of the 9 planetary boundaries. Fresh water is 2.5% of all the water on the Earth. And 2/3 of that is bound up in the ice cap and in the glacier. 0.8% flows around the world that you and I depend on for drinking water, along with other animals and plants. Less than 1%. And none of us walk on the planet with a sense of those metrics. That's a limited source. It's precious. And we do not walk on the planet with that sensitivity. So in the Global Freshwater Summit, what we were able to accomplish, red states, mind you, I learned a big lesson working in this region with others. And that is, if you get the language right, you will find that people love the water. They loved the river, and they were willing to act on it. Laura found a story when we were working on this together of a crawdad fisher who would never have understood the language that I would be bringing to this conversation. But one thing he did know is that the river was being treated poorly. He loved it, and he was tired of pulling refrigerators and trash out of the river. And he was going on a mission to raise money to clean up the river. The truth is, Missouri is one of those places that first won a fight, and it was a fight, with the Army Corps of Engineers to restore their own water system. It was a red state then, and it's a red state now. And they showed they were the first environmental organization to actually win a lawsuit with the Army Corps of Engineers. And so I didn't know going into this that I would find such allies, but we did. And so it really becomes a matter of language that we use in order to enlist and bring people to the table to work together. And the importance of being able to do that, to set a table where everyone can find themselves heard, where they can exist as they are, and participate in something together, is an art form right now. And it takes something, and I'm going to use terminology that comes from Joe Weston, who does work around the world at what he calls respectful confrontation, and now fierce civility. It takes fierce civility, which really encompasses what I have come to believe is most powerful, and that is our ability to hold the esteem of others as you hold it for yourself, seeing that there's a symbiosis between the two, that it's connected, like in the principles of Ubuntu that comes out of South Africa. That we have to hold value for one another across our differences, to be able to stand and speak truthfully, allow the others to do the same, and in that discourse, find out where we can work together. This is the work I enjoy doing, and in the course of the time that we worked on this river system, we were honoring the river from the headwaters all the way down to the summit where it comes into the Gulf Sea, and working with 124 STEM cities along that river with the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative, a group of mayors that work together, 69 or so, who have each other's backs when necessary, as it has been with the pandemic. Mayors whose states did not trickle down money for things like protection, mask, and that kind, that country like China ended up being a provider of resources for what these small city mayors needed in America. So we have our existential crisis consists of many things, and yet the opportunity, as I say, is very great because we have work that needs to be done. And a part of the what we know now, not only do we know in reality that we're a part of a world body, a planetary commons, if you will, that as humans, if there's anything to being a human, one of that must be able to care for, to be able to steward, to be able to preserve and conserve the environment, to be in relationship and to guide that. We also know a few other things that I think are important for me to point out before my time runs out. And that is, change can happen in a twinkling of an eye. Yeah. In 2005, a team of geologists landed on the open plains of Ethiopia, south of Ethiopia. And as the helicopter dropped them off on the ground and started to pull away, he noticed the ground shaking. He swooped back in, pulled the geologists up off the ground with as much equipment as they could, and pulled them away. And as they were pulling away, the geologists got a glimpse of an opening in the earth. An opening that we know now was a brand new ocean. And if they had not seen it with their own eyes, they would have said it was impossible. It has always been written that an ocean to form takes millions and millions of years in geological time. But in that instant, 60 kilometers opened up, and every day since, this has been widening. Eventually, Eritrea, some parts of Somalia will separate, and that will be a full-on ocean there. But the reality is, the workings of this planet are in large part a mystery. And we're in a time in which we're going to see things we don't expect to see. The scientists working on the IPCC report just said the heat dome we experienced in the Northeast throughout the United States, where we witnessed salmon in the waters of Canada cooked, as well as shrimp along the coast, that none of their modeling showed that kind of heat event being possible. None of it. And we are in for surprises, but I think the surprises I'm most interested in relaying to you is what can happen when we cooperate with the Earth system. We become collaborators, and we work at the get busy with restoration and regeneration. We have the whole southwest of the United States that will be without water. Planners in this country and the Northeast have been looking at the Rust Belt, realizing that part of the nation, the Northeast, is probably going to be inundated with migration within the United States. Because the Colorado no longer runs to the ocean. I grew up depending upon the Colorado River in Southern California. And in California, our own river systems have been diverted and dammed to where the salmon cannot make their complete runs. So we have changed the landscape. And as we've changed the landscape, we have changed the hydraulic cycle. And that's where it gets to the biosphere. I pay attention to the biosphere. That's the living space, by the way, that is holds us and allows us to have our being and walk in the world. And we walk on the earth without a working knowledge of how to be responsible within a living biosphere. So I got that title coming out of the planetary boundaries work as a diplomat of the biosphere. It was sort of play, but I took it on as if I am going to be responsible walking on the planet. That's human 101. And that's what my invitation is to all of us. Perhaps after we hear from Gar, we can have more conversation about this. But as I have worked so far in the municipalities, in local government, what I have come to know is if we can work locally where we can see the actual metrics, in other words, the inflow of money and coming in and coming out. We can count the homeless and be sure that they have habitats, just like the biodiversity in our communities, because the biodiversity is what underlies the restorative and regenerative power and resilience of the planet. And so when we get into our local communities and we orient to the watershed and we all become concerned about the health of the water system, we've gone a far way toward dealing with the health and well-being of us all. And once we do the work locally, what we can do to really tip the scales is to link with communities next to us. Make sure everyone's fed like my grandmother used to do in her Detroit community. Her block, every kid had what they needed for school. No one missed a meal because she could manage that. And we'll have to really come down small. We talk about scaling this way, but come down and then link to help the communities around you to do the same, so that we reach regional tipping points, because that's where the real tipping point happens for social systems. I would love to see a vision that we embody, that we do begin to identify by watershed, and we organize bioregionally, because it's the bioregions the source of what we depend upon on the earth that we must care for. Those boundaries to me are more important than our political boundaries, even our state lines and boundaries. So if there's going to be any kind of remapping, it's important that we include it so that one day we will have a measurement system in our the financial flows and the way we measure the economy that will also track how well we're doing with the earth itself. These metrics one day will make sense, I think, in a way that we look at the current way that we are measuring the economy and wonder how could we have given credence to things like war and emergency events that raise GDP. And we allow markets to signal us, to cause harm. We have this system, create the problem, bring the solution. And we've been caught up in that. That's where that obsolescence has come in, that economic obsolescence that came in as I was growing up. That spatula in my family home still works from way back in the 50s. So to build and create things that are meant to be in the landfill weeks after you've purchased it, and products that can't even break down, that's what happens when you have a system that signals you to do what doesn't make sense. And that's what we have to look at. That's our big reckoning. I think taking it back to the time that this nation came about is to look at language again. I took to the Oxford Dictionary a request to restore the capitalization of nature. Capital N-A-T-U-R-E. And the criteria that Oxford laid out was simple. Three different things. One, to find in the record that it exists in the language prior was one category that would allow them to take on such a request. And I did. In the English language, we used to capitalize the word nature. That went away in the industrial age. And our nation was formed at a time in which there was something happening to the fabric of our thinking as we enabled this massive slave trade, sanctioned by the Vatican, to be honest. These ships were sailing from different nations representing the monarchs, with papal bulls aboard, laying claim to everything that was discovered in people, in assets, and children, their faith. And so that enabled an environment, I feel, for us to lose the relationship we once had with nature, amongst all people, in a sense. And so one simple thing we can do is to recover the language that puts nature back in its rightful place. As you read our declaration, one of the things that is discussed in terms of life, liberty, and justice is this idea of nature, nature's rights being the foundation for those indivisible, inalienable rights. And now you can see why this deist thought probably is what led to that sentiment and those words. Obviously, on all the points raised, I could go on for very long, but I would like to just close it out with one quote, and that I'll have to go for because I've been talking from off of mind, and this quote I will have to read, so I really want to bring it in because it speaks to this. And it is this: a human being is part of the whole called by us universe. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from the prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. The true value of a human being is determined by the measure and the sense in which they have obtained liberation from the self. We shall require a substantially new manner of thinking if humanity is to survive. And that is Albert Einstein. I think it's time to bloom. Thank you for your attention.